the founder Aurelio Peccei realized very early, oh, yeah, the limits to growth, that was great, but this will not change the course of things. And why? And what are the obstacles? You know? And he got into this idea that part of the obstacles is the human mindset. And 7 years after the limits to growth, he promoted the publication of another report that almost nobody knows, titled No Limits to Learning, in which he says we have to learn what it takes to learn what we need to learn and learn it. So this is the riddle. The subtitle is Bridging the Human Gap. And the human gap for him is the difference between our capacity to act and our capacity to understand and deal with the consequences of our actions.
Hello, and welcome to the Inner Green Deal podcast, where we talk to inspiring guests about the human dimension of sustainability and explore the link between our personal journeys and the positive impacts we can have on the world. My name is Tamsin Walker, and my guest this month is Carlos Alvarez Pereira. He started out studying aerospace engineering and teaching applied mathematics before founding a research institute specializing in modeling complex systems and big data applications. And it's this interest in and affection for systems thinking that led him to his role as vice president of the Club of Rome, where he says the mission, simply put, is to ask better questions. Among the questions I'll be putting to Carlos today are why it's important to reconnect with ourselves, others, and the natural world as a way to navigate convergent crises, how we need to approach one another to move beyond polarization, and what lies at the heart of collective transformation.
Hello, Carlos, and welcome.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me to it.
You're very welcome. So I'll start with this question. I have heard you speak on more than one occasion about the importance of asking good questions. And I do hope that we'll talk about some good questions here today. But I want to start with a more simple question than perhaps some. It's all to do with place. And I did hear you talking about the importance of place and how we relate to different places. And I ask everybody who comes onto this show if they could cast their mind back to perhaps when they were growing up and to think of a place that feels particularly important to them. It might be a place in nature, or it might be a place that just was inspiring, or maybe something that has helped to form the person that you have become.
I love this question because, yes, indeed, I think our relationship with places is essential. Your question is related to the question of what is home? Where do we feel at home? And I feel at home in different places, and I cannot always explain easily why do I feel at home in this place. But I have the emotions. So the obvious response is the places where I grew up, and I was born in Paris, and I grew up in there. And so whenever I go to Paris, I feel at home because it reconnects me to not only with a familiar place, but with my childhood. Also another city which I feel strongly connected with, but also because I have family there, is Prague. Possibly, I'm more a city person than a nature person, even if I am advocating for our reconnection to life. And maybe that makes that I feel more at home in cities which are more of a human size and which are still like the human versions of nature, of a natural environment. And this brings me to the point where that one other element of feeling at home in a space, I think, is the sounds. I feel very much at home in places where people speak a language that I don't understand. So, for instance, Czech, that I don't understand, but I have four Czech cousins. And in childhood, I was used to hear them speaking in Czech. So it became a sort of music.
All right. So there's the connection, though, back to childhood.
Yeah. And so, for instance, I feel very much at home in Switzerland, or in small cities in the south of France, or in cities of Andalusia in Spain.
You're very lucky to feel at home in so many places, because I really genuinely think that that's not something that everybody can achieve. I think for a lot of people, we're striving to feel a sense of belonging. So to be able to, yeah, to feel that a place embraces you in a way that makes you feel at home, I think is really, it's a gift.
And talking about that, I am not super positive about the evolution of how places are conceived, although I see very positive trends now to from where we were maybe some decades ago. Plenty of people, of architects, but also city planners, have realized that cities can make people healthy or sick. A friend of mine investigated the influence of where people live, how cities are designed, and if there is a correlation between that and the impact of coronary disease. And in fact, he found that there is.
That doesn't surprise me. I think when you live in a city, then you're become very attuned to what it is that actually does make you feel good and what doesn't make you feel good. And it's not just the air pollution. It's also the ability to get outside and to be in underneath the trees. But I'm getting off topic there.
No, you are not. Sorry to say it, Tamsi. Just a last note on that. Because what his research found, what makes health is relationships. You talked about belonging. What makes us healthy and feel the well-being is our capacity to have relationships with others, I would say humans and non-humans. I'm convinced that it is loneliness, it is solitude which kills us. So one of the facts of life, I think, is this idea that life, health, well-being is relationships.
We're going to dig right into that. And I wanted to ask you, as somebody who works in complexity as a field, where your interest may have come from.
Yeah, let's say when I discovered that some people had been talking and writing and researching on something called complexity or complex systems, and then when I understood what it was about, it was sort of, oh yes, of course, kind of aha moment that yes, this is what everybody has to talk and think and work about. In general, complexity has a bad connotation. Sorry, complexity is life. Every human is a system thinker. And the difference is if you are privileged enough, as I was, in a quite peculiar way, that you have not lost, you have not or repressed your capacity to embrace complexity. So it's not a higher state to which you have to reach. It's just the natural state of humans, and as I say, all living beings, to embrace complexity, because complexity is life. So what makes something complex? A system is complex when it is made of many autonomous subsystems which are related to each other. And then the overall behavior of the system is a consequence of those relationships, of those interdependencies. Mm-hmm. And in my trajectory, maybe I had this privilege of not being curtailed by the dominant education, probably thanks to my parents. I mean, it's not only a banal demonstration of gratitude towards my parents. I think they were, while they were not well educated in the formal sense of the term, and they did not have the opportunity for that, but they were both very intelligent, but very curious. And also they had experiences in their lives which were not easy at all. They were both Spanish, but they couldn't live in their own country for many years, so they lived in different places, and that made, probably in a natural way, that made me feel like, oh, but the reality has more than one face. So coming back to the question of where do I feel at home, I feel very much at home having multiple lenses on the same topic at every moment.
That's a very nice thing to hear, that that's where you feel at home. And we are living through a complex moment in time, and in terms of multiple crises and all converging, the political, the environmental, the social crises, the economic crisis as well, and how they're all enmeshed and how they all feed into and also from one another, and underscoring this reality that nothing can happen in isolation. But there's also this growing body of evidence that one thing that they have in common is disconnection, this disconnection from one another, but also from the world around us, from the non-human, but also from ourselves, maybe first and foremost from ourselves. And I'd really like to hear your thoughts on that. What is going on there?
Good, very good question. I think we are seeing the cracks coming from these, the consequences of that disconnection at a massive scale. You know, the whole of modernity, with a capital M, if you wish, is built on separation, on our separation from nature, on our separation from other human beings, on the separation of reality and knowledge into disciplines, on the separation of the body and the mind, this weird idea that we have different parts in ourselves and some are better than others. So the ideal, in this perspective, the ideal is the rational mind, and then the rest, the non-rational mind, the emotions, and the body itself is a burden, and by the way, in many spiritual traditions, also the place of sin. So the paradox is that these the civilizations built on modernity have been extremely effective in changing the world, but with this very fragile foundation of separation. And our separation from nature has made us reluctant to consider the consequences of our actions on it, on nature. We cannot say, oh, we didn't know what would be the consequences of fossil fuels. Well, it's not that we didn't know, it's that we didn't care. Because if you care, I mean, you can think, well, I mean, look at coal or oil burning, and you can infer that, oh my God, this is releasing into the air something which is possibly not so good. So we didn't care. And this is the moment when we see the long-term effects of all these separations. And on your point of also reconnecting with ourselves, for sure, but it's, I would say very clearly, it's reconnecting, accepting that complexity is life. But then you have to take the lens of accepting ourselves as wholes. And at the same time of accepting the total ambiguity of being individuals, but being nothing as individuals.
I like that. Sorry, you know? Continue. Yes, absolutely. And being, but we find it difficult.
Yeah, because we are so excited about this individualistic perspective. Oh, and then I can do whatever I like, you know? And we lose in this obsession with individuality the core fact that without belonging, without being connected and dependent and interdependent with others, mm-hmm. we are not even individuals. Solitude kills us. The society of individuals, that's a nightmare.
So the facts are really then, A, we are disconnected, and B, we are in a place of multiple crises. We need to move away from this idea of the individual and to the collective. So we're talking about collective transformation here. I mean, this is also something that was laid out in the Inner Green Deal white paper. But I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how do we make the move towards a collective transformation that will benefit societies and move us through these crises and also help us to develop as people, as societies.
I would say by accepting ourselves as humans.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. We don't have access to reality. We have perceptions which we interpret according to certain mental frameworks, you know. And that situation means that we have blind spots. So you can have different glasses, but each of the lenses prevent you from seeing certain things, you know? And probably we are not able to free ourselves from for all our blind spots. Maybe we are not even able to conceive at a rational level what are all the blind spots. But the fact that we know we have blind spots is what makes the difference, you know? And then we can realize that the way we have been framing our lives, our stories, and particularly the way we have been framing the story of what is a successful life, and the way we have been framing that if there is something called professional life, which is again separated. So you as a professional, you are supposed to be a different person than you as a person, as a woman, as a sister, daughter, mother, whatever. Because as a professional, you have to forget all those dimensions. You have to forget your emotions and be only somebody focused on performance and productivity and rational thinking. So these are mental jail. And we have to create the conditions, in my view, for people to realize that, but also for them to realize that they are allowed to be humans in the whole sense of the term. So in my view, how do we get to this collective movement is first by betting on humanity and capacity of everybody, which is not what we are doing. We are still in the mindset of, oh, let's identify what are the right things to do, what are the right policies, whatever, and let's make these adopted by the top level decision-making level in our societies and we will be good. But this will not happen if we don't engage with people as people.
Let's just imagine for a moment a leader, a political leader, business leader. Well, how would a leader bring this concept to the people that they're leading? Because it could seem that it's a soft topic somehow, you know, although research shows that there's a hard nugget of potential at its core. But how do you communicate this need to allow people to be entire in order to move forward with the transformations that are necessary?
And here comes the good news. To communicate that, you just have to be yourself. So how do you allow people to be themselves? By being yourself. The point is that creating the conditions for change does not consist in telling to people what they have to think, does not consist in teaching them. It consists in realizing, but all of us, the leaders and the not leaders, we have been framed in these mental jails which are leading us to, at the same time, thriving, because in many ways we would say, oh, society is thriving, and disaster and suicide at the same time. And then it's a matter of not of teaching people what they have to think. It's a matter of reestablishing the trust by saying why there is a crisis in trust or a huge amount of mistrust, because the institutions of modernity do not trust people, because they have been designed on the idea of controlling them. They have been designed on the idea of distrust them. So people sense that, yeah, my state doesn't trust me, so I will not trust the state. And I know this will sound totally weird, because it's so much out of the landscape that we see, where people are in fear. And a natural thing when you are in fear is to look for leaders who seem to know where to go. The transformational leader, if something of that kind can exist, is one who would have the humility to recognize that he or she doesn't know. So it's not about telling people what they have to think. It's about creating the conditions for them to live helplessness. But what about not saying to them, trust me, or not saying to them, but you are allowed, but showing with actions that, yes, they are not only allowed, but invited to get out of helplessness. You know?
But so there must be in all of that, the innate knowledge and skills that we have, the innate connection that we are able to make to those around us, to nature. But I sense that there's quite a bit to cut through before we can get to those connections. I'm wondering, what is the starting point? Is it also, as you're saying, just be yourself, just be? But I'm struggling to grasp how people, if they're not aware of the disconnection, how do we make them aware in order that they can get closer to a place of reconnection?
Yeah, very good question. I mean, what I can say, I mean, there are many attempts at doing that. Some of those attempts are based on, let's say, an elaboration of rituals and prescribed steps towards reconnection. I respect all these attempts. Myself, I'm more on the side of something which is even simpler than that. What about allowing people to have feelings in these processes of discussing big matters like climate change? What about saying we are not rational beings? Let's kill that fantasy, that terribly misleading fantasy. In general, my experience is that even in individual conversation, even in this conversation we are having, it's about, what am I doing? Just allowing you to be yourself by being myself, Tamsin.
Yes, and it's very pleasant.
Thank you. The same. So it's not about convincing people of something. It's not about campaigning. What I'm saying is that either we take at the same time this humanistic perspective and work with people that way, or the campaigning will actually contribute to the polarization.
Oh, yes, I want to talk about that.
If we stay in the us and them divide, in what I call the fantasy of exclusion, us and them, this is not going against polarization. And this is not going to create progress. If you don't get out of the framework that some people are simply stupid, they don't understand, they have to be educated, they have to be forced into something, don't expect that to create trust. It will only create more anger and more sense of humiliation by people who already feel humiliated. And I'm not saying that they are right in all what they think. No, no. I'm saying they feel left behind. They feel changes which are happening, they don't connect with them, but those changes are considered as the good ones. And then their way of living is considered as a bad one, as backward. If you don't get out of the us and them framework, and us and them is always the path towards exclusion, towards exploitation, especially towards the feeling of us, we are the good ones. And we are not calling to their humanity. We are calling to them to be also more part of an us and them. And then we have the fractures going deeper and deeper, and terrible things happening, as we see in the newspapers or in the TV news. So I don't know how this could work at a massive scale, but let's not be anxious about immediately knowing. A friend of mine told me the other day, let's be at peace, or let's make peace with not knowing, because there is also a lot of anxiety of, oh, but to take the first step, we need to know that that first step will lead in a linear and straightforward way to a better future.
Can I pick up on polarization? Because it's impossible to overlook in our society, and the fact that we have at our fingertips access to opinions that give us some sense of community, and we're being fed things designed to bring us into communities. Given the fact that polarization is already there and all the things that you just laid out, the them and us and the moral high ground and so on, it's kind of not surprising that people retreat ever deeper into their own worlds where they feel some degree of relative security, but it's not helpful, right? So I'm also wondering there, I mean, clearly reconnection is a part of breaking away from polarization. But the inner transformation, the ability to create space within oneself also for other narratives, for other opinions, to have conversations instead of locking horns as a sort of knee-jerk reaction. I wonder what you think about this inner development that can be the catalyst for creating the space for the conversations to move beyond polarization. Sounds like a very lofty aim.
And at the same time, very much needed. I don't know. I know what I'm trying and what that the kind of reactions that creates. But I also know incredible things which happen in spaces where we don't look. I think that in these circumstances, we, meaning the people, meaning the privileged people in industrialized countries, we are much more far away from the existential challenge. Let's be honest with ourselves, the existential threats for humanity are not for the moment existential to me directly. So I'm in a comfortable position and privileged position of having many layers of disconnection between the real threats and me. The Club of Rome organized the annual conference last year in Costa Rica, and by listening to many people, different places, countries in Latin America, I realized that, well, those people know perfectly well what is collapse. It's not an abstract concept to them. It's not something which could happen in the future, and let's try to avoid that. They are living in it. People who are in countries where it's much more difficult to live every day than we do here are the vanguard of humanity. And maybe what we have to do is to learn from them. And in some cases, they do incredible things, which we don't see, because also those incredible things do not fit the mainstream frameworks, the mainstream thinking we have, even the mainstream thinking about transformation and social transformation. And I know several examples of communities, the LEAP schools in South Africa, the Tankin Foundation in Morocco, the Constellation Network in many different countries, which have been able during long periods of time, 15, 20 years, to build communities from the assumption that people are not helpless. They just feel helpless. They are jailed in this helplessness. And from a perspective of very humble leadership, they could create the conditions for the people of the communities too. How to get there? I see this as something happening in a collective, but the collective that can mean many different things in many different places. Facing context and particularly facing critical situations, it's almost necessary to face the critical situations, because without that, to be honest, I think we don't learn. So criticality is a precondition to open the space of possibilities. Of course, it can lead to very bad things, but it is also the precondition for the emergence of something truly different. It's not about prescribing how the process has to happen. It's very much about making people feel allowed to go their own way. I allow you to be yourself by being myself. But all initiatives are welcome in a way, because we don't know yet what will be the solution. I know it sounds very difficult, but how do we get engaged with people who are, let's say, on the other side of this us and them divide? Yeah, but that's what we have to do, to engage with them. They are also humans.
But that's also where the conversation comes into play.
Here we go. I think it's all about conversations, and conversations in the wide sense of the term. We are in permanent conversations with our environment, meaning many different things, many different kinds of things. But yes, exactly. You cannot fake feeling trust. And it's not by using certain words. If I tell you, Tamsin, trust me, the natural thing that you would do is to run away.
What could possibly go wrong? One thing that I had been going to ask you was also about this idea of like the human dimension was sort of in the DNA of the Club of Rome. And I was wondering to what degree that's still the case.
Very much so. And actually, we are coming back to our roots in that sense, because the success and failure of the Limits to Growth overshadows the whole history of the Club of Rome. It's like, oh, we are the ones who did the Limits to Growth, and that's it. And we are very proud of that heritage, for sure, of the fact that the success was editorial success, millions of copies sold. The failure was, oh, but it didn't change the course of things. And then there was a process of reflection, because the founder, Aurelio Peche, realized very early, oh, yeah, the Limits to Growth, that was great, but this will not change the course of things. And why? And what are the obstacles? And he got into this idea that part of the obstacles is the human mindset. And 7 years after the Limits to Growth, He promoted the publication of another report that almost nobody knows, titled No Limits to Learning, in which he says we have to learn what it takes to learn what we need to learn and learn it. So this is the riddle. The subtitle is Bridging the Human Gap. And the human gap for him is the difference between our capacity to act and our capacity to understand and deal with the consequences of our actions. 5 years later, the year that Aurelio died, he had still time to publish another book, which is a book of conversations with a Japanese author, Daisaku Ikeda, titled Before It Is Too Late, and where they call for a human revolution, a revolution in mindset to overcome this human gap, to overcome this gap between how we think and how nature works. So we are reconnecting with that through many of our activities, and in particular, thanks to, or in collaboration with, one of our, what we call impact hubs. It's called Emerging New Civilizations. And in my view, it's actually happening already. It's already emerging. And there are seeds all around of that. We just have to pay attention to those seeds and creating the conditions for the seeds to grow, you know? And at the core of all of it is humanistic, deeply humanistic perspective, which is, I think, the only way that you can be optimistic, or at least not optimistic, hopeful.
And we really, really need to remain hopeful. And because we've been talking about not only connecting with other people, but also connecting with the other than human, I wanted to ask you a little bit about nature, although you said at the beginning that you were more of a city person. But at the moment, nature is something that we as human beings tend to see as just ours for the taking. We can commodify it and do with it what we will, completely forgetting that we're degrading our own existence in the process. What role do you think nature can actually play in helping with the collective transformation?
I mean, that's a very good question, because I'm tempted to answer what I think also applies to art. And artistic practices nowadays, which is that nature is taken as, at best, as decoration. At best, I mean, at worst, of course, it is a resource that we can exploit and destroy, etc. And we have been trying for centuries to isolate ourselves from nature more and more. In a way, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if we continue in that direction, what nature, what life will do is to get rid of ourselves. And I mean, this is an obvious thing to me, that we don't have the capacity to kill the planet, or we don't have the capacity to kill life. We are just killing ourselves. So one is for sure experiencing nature, but another is, which for me is even more important, is life as an inspiration to change our worldviews, our ways of understanding what is and what we have and our place in the world. And in that sense, I'm fascinated by all those experiments that now some researchers do to find out that animals are sentient, are conscious, have consciousness. Think of any animal on earth, plants, trees. You know, it's fascinating to see how many things trees can do by communicating just by being trees. So look at that, and you will realize that every living being on earth is able to do things that we are not able to do.
And that actually also brings me to the final question. I ask this question of everybody, and it's, if there were one skill that you wish everybody in the world had, what would it be?
Wow, very good question. I think if I have to choose one, I would say the relationship with multiple languages.
Oh, and can you explain why?
Yes, because, and when I say multiple languages, I'm not including only the verbal languages. So artistic practices are languages as well, or mathematics is a language. So I would say, because it gives these multiple perspectives, the capacity to see things in different ways, to recognize the other as well, and to engage in conversations.
Oh, I think that's lovely. As someone who very much enjoys language, I can relate to that.
Yep, that would be my answer.
I thank you very much for your time and for sharing all of these insights with me. It's been a real pleasure.
For me too. It was a pleasure, really. I enjoyed it.
And I thank you for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Carlos. And if you'd like to know more about the Club of Rome, you'll find a link in the show notes. For other episodes, please feel free to subscribe wherever you usually get your podcasts. And of course, to join me again next time for more of the Inner Green Deal podcast. For now, though, goodbye.